Hello and welcome to Small Town Spooky, the podcast broadcast from a spooky small town near you. I'm Renee Malosh, and I'll be your sonic psychopomp leading you into the legends, folklore, and spooky stories from small towns all over the world. Small Town Spooky is part history, part mystery, and 100% oddity. So get curious, get creepy, and join the ghoul gang as we investigate the obscure horrors of our hometowns. I just wanted to say thank you to everyone who has unofficially joined the Ghoul Gang, and for all the kind messages, comments, shares, and interaction from everyone on social media. It means a lot. I really do care about making Small Town Spooky as good as it can be, and I hope to keep it going for as long as I can. So today's episode is a bit of a different format than the first. I'm going to talk a little about several different places, all purportedly haunted, from my current hometown. And I also want to set aside some time at the top here to share some of the kind words from listeners. So thank you to Devona Map at Devona Map underscore author for your shout out on Instagram and 5-star review on iTunes and your comment. Renee's approach from multiple angles was interesting from start to finish, including geography was really helpful as someone who has been to the area and isn't from Canada. Her commentary was witty and entertaining, and her voice was perfect for the mood and tone she presented with the episode. This was a lovely opener. I can't wait to hear more. Thank you so much, Devona. I really appreciate it. And thank you to Victoria Bradley, at Victoria with a K Reads Books, who is the co-host of Interdisciplinary History Pod, for your shares on social media. If you haven't listened, IHP is a really excellent, thoughtful, and deeply researched podcast that features interviews with academics, book and television reviews and analyses, all from an interdisciplinary and historical lens. I want to thank everyone as well for the suggested episode topics that I've received so far. I'm going to list a few, and if any strike your fancy, I'll be polling people about it on social media in the coming weeks, so make sure you vote for your favorite. And if you don't hear any that you like, you can email smalltownspooky@gmail.com and send in your suggestion. So a couple of options. We have the Ottawa Jail, which is a hostel now, and then a student dormitory at Brentwood, which is a boarding school in BC that apparently is extremely haunted and used to be a nurse's dorm when the school was still a sanitarium. So if either of those options seem interesting to you, or you have another suggestion that you'd like to share, you can DM me on the socials at smalltownspooky, or you can email me at smalltownspooky@gmail.com, and keep an eye out for that social media poll. I'll be running that for a little while and hopefully announce the winner in our Halloween episode. The landscape confounds the eye. You touched down in an airport after flying through bluebird skies where you looked out the window and saw white-capped mountains, their rugged stone faces carved by wind and rain. Now, those same forms are visible in the distance, hazy through the blinding glare of the midday sun. The brilliance is deceiving. When you step outside, a cutting wind assails you and you wrap your coat around yourself a little tighter. The airport staff welcomes you to Calgary, and you linger by the gate, taking in the travel-worn faces of your fellow passengers. You pull a pamphlet from a nearby kiosk when its cover draws your gaze. Leafy, deep green pines and bizarre striated stone pillars are displayed next to endless flowering yellow fields and grazing cattle. At the bottom, a pristine lake the color of the truest teal you've ever seen is nestled under the impassive faces of those snow-capped Rocky Mountains. The pamphlet is emblazoned at the top with three words, "Welcome to Alberta." Oh, Alberta. I had never been west of Georgian Bay when I took a plane for the first time in 2011 and ended up on the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains. Before that, Alberta didn't strike me as a place where people lived, so much as a layover between Ontario and British Columbia. I don't mean to sound dismissive. I grew up a sheltered, poorly traveled white kid who, like most sheltered white kids born in small town southwestern Ontario, considered Ottawa the geographical center of Canada. I first came to Alberta for a four-month contract, which I refer to as a working holiday, at the Jasper Park Lodge. Jasper Park Lodge has its own ghost stories, which I might have to delve into in another episode. I was completely boggled by the scale, and honestly, there's no other word for it, majesty of the Rocky Mountains, having seen nothing taller than a landfill hill before coming out here. I met my partner that summer, and 10 years later, we're married and living in Edmonton, but that's a story for another podcast. A few years ago now, my spouse and I took the Old Strathcona Tour with Edmonton Ghost Tours, hosted by Nadine Bailey. We walked around one of the oldest parts of Edmonton and saw some of the purportedly haunted locales, which includes the Strathcona Hotel, the Princess Theater, the Strathcona High School, the Walterdale Playhouse, the Arts Barn, etc. We didn't see anything. Probably the most memorable part of the tour was the person who wore a horse head mask the entire time without taking it off. Very scary, and it can't have been comfortable. I want to include a trigger warning for this week's episode, particularly. From the historical side, it's a heavy one. Content includes discussion of medical mistreatment, physical and sexual abuse of First Nations people, genocide, and racism. Also, mentions of suicide, homicide, and violence. Now, let's ghost into it. The Nehiyawewin Plains Cree place name for Edmonton area is Amiskwachiwa Skygin, meaning Beaver Hills House. This was the traditional meeting place for many First Nations people, including Nehiyawak Cree, Sotol, Nakota Sioux, Niitsitapi, Blackfoot, Sutina, Rodine, and Métis people, and it was located at the intersection of many travel and trade routes they used before colonial contact. The North Saskatchewan River was an important transportation and trade route for these groups. It gets its name from the Nehiyawewin Ki Saskatchewanisipi, which means river with a swift current. In the late 1700s, the British claimed an area of land surrounding Hudson Bay and its drainage basin, asserting their ownership over it while ignoring the indigenous people who had lived, hunted, and looked after the land for thousands of years already. This area encompassed much of Ontario, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan, and the lower half of Alberta, south of what would eventually become Edmonton. Meanwhile, European colonists arrived in this area and established fortified settlements from which to conduct trade with First Nations bands and other settlers on the banks of the North Saskatchewan River. The first European settlers in the Edmonton or Beaver Hills region were associated with the Northwest Company of Montreal, who established themselves in northern Alberta in 1779 to compete with the Hudson Bay Company. Fort Augustus was established by the Hudson Bay Company in 1794, so just about 50 years after the first colonial settlements in southwestern Ontario that I mentioned in Small Town Spooky Episode 1. Less than a year later, Fort Edmonton was built. It took its name from Edmonton, England, the birthplace of Sir James Winter Lake, a member of the Hudson's Bay Company board. Even after it was officially named by the HBC, Fort Edmonton continued to be called other things by the people who came to trade. The Nehiyawak Cree continued to call it Amiskwachiwaskegan, the Nakota Sioux called it Teota, meaning many houses, and the Niitsitapi called it Amakosis or Omakoyis, Big Lodge, and these are just the names I was able to find. Forts Edmonton and Augustus operated profitable trading posts until the early 1800s, when the fur trade started to decline. In 1802, both forts were relocated to the north bank of the North Saskatchewan River, which is where the downtown district of Edmonton is presently located. The Northwest Company was predominantly run by titled Scots settlers in Canada, think baronets, who employed settlers from the Montreal region referred to as Canadiens, in this context meaning impoverished farmers who were often of Métis heritage. The Northwest Company and the Hudson's Bay Company were such fierce competitors that their rivalry escalated to armed conflict before the British Crown intervened and forced the companies to merge in 1821, becoming consolidated under the name Hudson's Bay Company. From HBCHeritage.com, Fort Edmonton was selected as the district headquarters for the North Saskatchewan region. Under Chief Factor John Rowand, it became one of the largest and most important posts in what would become Alberta. An administrative center, warehouse, and storage facility, it was also a place where goods were manufactured by tradesmen as well as a source of provisions for other posts. Fort Edmonton was a meat post. Much of the pemmican and dried and fresh buffalo meat consumed by fur traders came from there. It also produced the York boats used to transport fur and trade goods to and from Hudson Bay. The fort enjoyed its most prosperous time from 1826 to 1853. In 1870, shortly after its formation, the Canadian government purchased the area designated by the British Crown as Rupert's Land, that portion of southern Alberta they had claimed. Meanwhile, the northern portion of Alberta was considered part of the Northwest Territories until 1876, when the Crown finally agreed to negotiate with First Nation groups for their rights to the land they had always stewarded and lived on. During this time, pressures from settlers moving up to Canada from the United States, or United Empire loyalists fleeing to Canada, in addition to the activity of the fur trade, were acting on the bison population in Alberta. The First Nations chiefs, concerned for their communities, believed that securing treaties with the Crown would afford them some food security and pull a break on the decimation of the buffalo population. The treaty agreements negotiated in Alberta were treaties numbered 6, 7, and 8. Treaty 6, where Edmonton is located, was signed between the Crown and the Plains and Woods Cree, Assiniboine, and Ojibwe band chiefs. The treaties, when they were finally made, were negotiated in bad faith by the Crown. The Plains First Nations had been attempting to negotiate with the government since as early as 1871, due to their concerns about starvation, illness, and death among the different lodges, from European diseases such as smallpox and encroachment from white settlers. The government declined to negotiate, despite local missionaries and government agents urging them to do so, until members of the Cree First Nations stopped Canadian Geological Survey agents from moving any farther past the elbow of the North Saskatchewan River. Lawrence Clark, the manager at the Hudson's Bay Company outpost Fort Carlton, also wrote to the Canadian government to inform them that the Cree were threatening to turn back workers trying to establish a telegraph line between Winnipeg and Edmonton, prompting a mounted police detachment to be sent into the area. Alexander Morris, the Lieutenant Governor of Manitoba and the Northwest Territories at the time, further agitated for treaty, as they were, in his opinion, the Canadian government's primary path to accessing and developing land. The First Nations chiefs, concerned for their communities, were assured that, quote, the Queen's care for her Indian subjects, end quote, would be paramount. However, interpretation of the treaties show that the Crown intended, from the get, to annex the land designated by the agreements and place it under the Canadian government's sovereignty, whereas the First Nations bands understood that these lands would be used by settlers in a way similar to their own interaction and stewardship of it. Here I want to give a more complete explanation of what I mean by Indigenous stewardship of the environment, although I can't encompass the full breadth and depth of every Indigenous culture's knowledge, relationship, and approach. The Alberta Civil Liberties Research Center provides what I consider a helpful primer. While there is no monolithic Indigenous culture in Canada, some overarching values are common to most Indigenous communities. This connection is particularly evident in relation to the environment and humanity's role within it. Indigenous peoples living in Canada possess a deep and spiritual connection to the land. The term environment from a traditional First Nations perspective does not distinguish between humanity and everything else, Humans are part of the environment as much as are the fish, wildlife, air, and trees. Traditionally, First Nations use of the land recognized the impact on other species around us, and we were respectful of the impact we imposed. We do not view people as the masters of the earth, but merely a part of the delicate balance of the earth's cycle of life. We are aware that our lives depend on observing and honoring this balance. While early European settlers may have recognized the connection First Nations people had with the land, this was largely in a racist way that characterized them as primitive and less evolved than white people, e.g., closer to animals. This is not to say that indigenous ways of stewarding the land were only ever without conflict, difficulties, or unintended negative consequences, only that the colonial settlers brought with them different intent and cultural baggage that they imposed on land management. Historical records from the Canadian Geological Survey, established in 1842, show that the Canadian government's interest in mapping landscape was primarily motivated by the exploitation of natural resources and, quote, part of a broader project of promoting the settlement of the frontier by white subjects loyal to the British Crown, end quote. This had a massive impact on First Nations' relationship to the natural resources of their traditional land. Treaty 6 was meant to provide reserves, tracts of land marked for sole First Nations occupation, reserved from the acquisitive gaze of white settlers. It also included the provision of livestock and farm equipment from the Crown, the promise of schoolhouses for, quote, optional education of First Nations children, and a medicine chest clause, which was a guarantee of government assistance in the case of famine, illness, or pestilence within the First Nations bands. You can see how these terms deteriorated as the Canadian government imposed their edicts on these First Nations communities once they were considered treaty people. The optional education, meant to facilitate communication between European settlers and First Nations, became the residential school system, institutions run by the Catholic Church where children were removed to and subject to physical, psychological, and sexual abuse. Many children died of disease, malnutrition, abuse, and neglect, and those who did survive are still suffering the after effects, or have inherited generational trauma from their parents' and grandparents' suffering. The Catholic Church was successfully sued in 2006 to make restitution to residential school survivors to the tune of $21 million. The church not only failed to make those restitutions in full, they negotiated a deal with the federal government for $1.2 million settlement that effectively enabled them to wash their hands of any remaining obligation to repay the residential school survivors. The basis for this negotiation was that the Catholic Church was not able to raise the funds. However, a Globe and Mail investigation conducted in August of 2021, which analyzed tax records of the Catholic Church's holdings, revealed that, in all, the Catholic Church in Canada's net assets totaled $4.1 billion in 2019, and that it had received $886 million in donations. With the discoveries of over 4,000 children, as tallied by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, buried in unmarked graves at former Catholic-run residential school sites since 2015, this number is only growing. In 2021, more than 1,300 suspected graves have been found. Canada had over 130 residential schools in operation between 1831 and 1996, and of those, only 7 have been completely searched. If you are a former residential school student in distress or have been affected by the residential school systems and need help, you can contact the 24-hour Indian Residential Schools Crisis Line at 1-866-925-4419 I will also link additional and online resources in the episode description and blog post for this episode. I don't mean to overwhelm this episode with this content, but this history of what I can only qualify as Canada's genocidal treatment of First Nations people since its inception is relevant as we go forward with our exploration of some of Edmonton's most reputedly haunted locations. If you need to take a break after hearing all of that, please take one. I'll be here when you get back. Edmonton itself wasn't officially established as a town until 1894, but prior to that, small settlements cropped up around Fort Edmonton in the form of pioneer farms. Think log cabins and plots of land along the river. These are some of the most highly valued properties in Edmonton today. A railway from Calgary was built across Edmonton in 1903, and by 1904, Edmonton, with a mere 5,000 person population, was named Alberta's capital. In 1912, Edmonton amalgamated the city of Strathcona, which was predominantly located on the southern banks of the North Saskatchewan River. When I was researching this episode, I quickly discovered there are more than a few haunted venues to choose from in Edmonton. Some honorable mentions include the B Wing of Edmonton General Hospital, the Firkins House at Fort Edmonton Park, and even downtown, the Hotel McDonald, named for one of Canada's arguably most corrupt and genocidal prime ministers, with its dramatic French Renaissance architecture that overlooks the river valley. Hotel Mac is rumored to have a ghostly carriage drawn by a horse that can be heard clopping along the top floor hallway. It may or may not be the spirit of a poor, exhausted creature that dropped dead as the foundation for the building was being poured in 1914. The Highlands neighborhood hosts its own purportedly paranormal site too, La Boheme, the former restaurant and bed and breakfast, which closed in 2018. A 1913 historic building, originally built as luxury apartments with pressed tin ceilings, La Boheme is supposedly haunted by something that has lifted guest beds right off the floor in the middle of the night. The former caretaker of the building was rumored to have murdered his wife and dragged her down to the basement, cremating her remains in the cast iron furnace there. The Strathcona area of Edmonton has more than a few locales to choose from when searching for ghost stories, including the Walterdale Playhouse, a former fire hall that is supposedly haunted by firefighters in old-fashioned gear and horses, where lights come on or bells ring inexplicably in the building. But the veritable crown in the jewel of haunted Strathcona spots has got to be the Princess Theatre. The Princess Theatre was built in 1913 and it's a historic building. It's one of the last of the old-fashioned theatres in Western Canada. Walk along White Avenue today and you'll hardly be able to miss it. The white marble facade of the building is still intact. All three stories boast classical and symmetrical features with rows of black blocked windows and two gables with copper cornices set on either end of the roof. If you look past the massive retro-style marquee with its iconic yellow bulbs up to the second story, you can see a massive scroll engraved into the facade of the building bearing the name of the man who commissioned the theater's construction, J.W. McKernan, and the year it was completed, 1914. When the theater opened in 1915, it offered moving picture shows, musical vaudeville and concerts, and a billiard and games room in the basement. Go inside today and you'll see the red velvet covered chairs and the scalloped backs of the shell-shaped brass footlights edging the stage. The balcony boxes are still decorated with raised sculptural details and the arched ceiling is picked out in plaster friezes and figures evoking a neoclassical sensibility. When it first opened, the theater's frescoes and gold leaf decoration, in addition to its modern amenities like an electric ticketing machine, refrigerated drinking fountain, and heating and cooling ventilation system, were noteworthy and drew large crowds. In less than a year, the theater switched exclusively to cinema and newsreels, earning its revenue primarily from its two screens and from the rental spaces in the basement and upper floors. The Henderson City Directory for Edmonton from 1916 does list the Princess Theater as some residents' addresses, including a pianist, a cashier, and an operations manager. According to what I could find, the rental units would have been on the second floor of this building. Nadine Bailey, storyteller and guide of Edmonton Ghost Tours, says the staff at the Princess Theatre have seen a woman in white haunting the premises. They've seen her walking around the central lobby, up and down the grand staircase, and hovering above the projection room. Bailey further details this story in her podcast, Haunted Canada, in episode 3, where she gives the woman's name as Sarah Ann and says she lived in 1917 and conceived a child out of wedlock. In the story, the woman is staying on the third floor of the Princess, though, as I said, the records I found indicated the rooms to let were on the second floor. When Sarah Ann tells the father of her child that she's pregnant, he agrees to marry her and keep their secret. Sarah Ann goes out to purchase a wedding dress in anticipation of the day, only to discover that her lover has fled. Unable to face life as an unwed mother, Sarah Ann dresses herself in her wedding gown, this symbol of her ruined prospects, and hangs herself in her apartment, where her body stays undiscovered for over 2 weeks until the arrival of the landlord who has come collecting rent. In addition to the full-body apparitions, employees of the theater have cited flickering lights and disembodied voices as further evidence of unearthly activity. The Princess Theater is still open and operating today, with only one screen that shows independent movies and art house films. I myself saw Spice World there a few years ago, the noted cinematic classic. And I know that they do showings of Rocky Horror Picture Show, so if you are local, be sure to check that out. Our second site has one of the most macabre and disgusting histories I've ever read, not only just in terms of what was done there, but also what it says about Canada's history as a country. Charles Camsell Hospital was the site of horrific mistreatment and abuse of First Nations people in Edmonton. The building was constructed in 1914 as Francis Xavier Academy by Jesuits, essentially a missionary brotherhood formed under the Roman Catholic faith, who were some of the earliest colonial settlers in Canada, missionaries who accompanied those who followed the fur trade. Francis Xavier Academy was a college for young boys, sorry, no X-Men here, and then later purchased by the American Army during World War II for use as their base for the construction of the Alaska Highway. The Government of Canada bought the building in 1944, and the Royal Canadian Army Medical Corps set it up as a hospital for veterans. In 1945, the hospital was approved to treat First Nations groups from Alberta, the Yukon, parts of the Northwest Territories, and Alaska for tuberculosis, and was jointly run by the Indian Health Services Department of the Canadian government. I couldn't find much about who directed the hospital during this time. I did find a bit on Wikipedia about Dr. Otto Schaefer, a Canadian-German doctor who headed the Northern Medical Research Unit for the Department of Indian Affairs, and who published findings based on his travels into remote northern communities where he engaged with First Nations people and administered vaccines. His paper stated that First Nations peoples' traditional cultural, dietary, and social modes of living should be protected, or that their populations would be decimated and suffer great negative health consequences. At the same time, however, Camsell Hospital was operating under the purview of the Alberta Eugenics Board and forcibly sterilizing First Nations people. Notable proponents of the eugenics movement in Canada included members of Alberta's Famous Five who fought for women to be included under the legal definition of persons, Judge Emily Murphy, politicians Louise McKinney and Irene Parlby, and author Nellie McClung. First Nations people from all over Alberta and the rest of Canada were often forcibly removed from their families and communities and brought to Camsell on the pretext of combating tuberculosis. From ualbertalaw.typepad.com, their blog post titled Edmonton's Own Hospital of Horrors, posted by the organization Reconciliation YEG. While at the hospital, Indigenous patients received medical care that often went far beyond the usual practices to combat TB. Accounts of the traumatic and oppressive practices have been the subject of many news stories, books, and documentaries over the past two decades. Such experiences include children being routinely tied up at night, face down, so they would not cause disruptions to other patients and medical staff. Further experiences of abuse within the hospital include experimental surgeries, drug testing, forced sterilization, and shock treatment. In addition, allegations of sexual assault, beatings, isolation in rooms for long periods of time, food and drink deprivation, forced feeding, and forcible eating of patients' own vomit have been made by victims of the Camsell staff. Of the above horrific experiences, stories of forced sterilization have been revealed increasingly over time by ex-patients of the Camsell. One such story of the forced sterilization of Indigenous women while in the care of the Charles Camsell came from priest René Fumolo. Fumolo indicated that some women from Denende, located in the Northwest Territories, came to him with concerns of why they were no longer able to have children. Upon further medical assessment, the women discovered that following the birth of their children in the Camsell Hospital, they had been sterilized without their permission or knowledge of the procedure. The government of Alberta has paid out more than $50 million to those wrongfully sterilized. We can't know the full scale of the impact that Charles Camsell and other hospitals like it had on First Nations communities until these institutions respond to government or public pressure to release their records. By 1953, there were nearly 3,000 Inuit admitted to TB hospitals all across Canada, and in 2016, Inuit elders from Cambridge Bay came to pay respects to the 98 Inuit, including 31 children, who were taken to Camsell and never returned home. Many people have yet to find hospital records to determine what happened to their children and other loved ones. The book Separate Beds, A History of Indian Hospitals in Canada by Maureen K. Lux attempts to provide a history of these institutions and includes many first-hand accounts of the patients of Camsell and other so-called Indian hospitals from the 1920s to the 1980s. The book details the history of staffing, operations, and the development of national health policies, also exploring the relationship between the federal government's accountabilities regarding First Nations communities' health care and how this relates to the original Medicine Chest Clause written into Treaty 6. As recently as 2021, class action lawsuits have been leveled against hospitals and other medical institutions, including Charles Camsell Hospital, with plaintiffs alleging widespread sexual abuse, mistreatment of patients, and its implication in the 60s scoop, where First Nations children were abducted by Canadian federal or military employees under the pretense of healthcare or education, and fostered or adopted out to white Christian families and institutions where they were largely subject to trauma, loss of culture, appalling treatment, and abuse. I don't want to name any of the plaintiffs. You can see the sources in the episode log transcript and go read, but there are people living today who are still suffering from what they say they experienced. And if that weren't enough, in July 2021, construction crews actually paused development on the former Charles Camsell Hospital site to run a ground-penetrating radar search for potential mass graves. Almost 200 years into our history, Canada's legacy of genocide against First Nations people still has yet to be properly acknowledged, addressed, and reconciled. Camcel attracted amateur ghost hunters and thrill seekers before its sale in 2004 and the demolition of the hospital several years ago for the construction of apartment complexes. People reported disembodied screaming, flickering lights, and the feeling of being observed from the windows, and even the apparition of a teenage girl who had apparently ripped out her own fingernails. The Paranormal Explorers, a team from Edmonton, visited Camcel in 2005 and claimed that everyone involved felt physically ill or experienced vivid nightmares after returning home from their stay overnight in the hospital, and that they witnessed powerless elevators moving on their own, heard footsteps in unoccupied parts of the building, and picked up strange chatter on their walkie-talkies and heard the unearthly screaming. I spoke to a local Edmontonian, my friend S, who was born and raised here, and they told me about their experience breaking into Camcel as a teenager. It was the thing that everyone did. Everyone I knew in high school broke into this hospital at one point. You start hearing about it in grade 11. So, one winter day in 2009, S and about six or seven of their friends jumped the perimeter fence, crossed the open field, and headed for the abandoned hospital. Their friend, let's call him Zane, had been there before and showed them the way in, a side door where the lock was busted. The teens explored the main floor before heading upstairs, where overturned furniture, tables and chairs, room dividers with the curtains still attached, and other hospital equipment littered the floors. It had that left in a hurry feeling, S told me. We wondered, why wasn't this building fully emptied? There was no power to the building. The only light came from windows and large gaps in the walls where the facade of the building had deteriorated. There were holes in the floor, too, and cracks in some of the doors, but the air was completely still, as if the building existed in its own ghostly climate. It should have been drafty, but it wasn't. The teens kept going, all the way up to the roof. They were able to access it because none of the locks in the building's doors were still properly functional. From the roof, they could look out on the whole neighborhood, peacefully blanketed by snow. Then someone suggested the group head back down, all the way down. They took the deserted stairway to the basement floor. As they descended, a noise finally registered, a faint, continuous noise, like the entire building was groaning or shifting in the wind. When they reached the basement, they could hardly see, and it felt colder than any part of the building had before. Peering down into the darkness, someone finally realized what they were looking at. The entire basement floor was encased in ice. Flooding had filled the basement with about 6 feet of water, and it had frozen solid in the winter months. The only part of the basement still visible was the foot or so between the top of the ice and the ceiling. Suddenly, a door creaked and slammed shut somewhere upstairs. Spooked, the teens scrambled back up the stairs and back out the side door where they'd come in. They crossed the wide open field in a hurry, and just as they cleared the fence, a police cruiser came creeping down the road. The teens turned the corner and continued down the block as though nothing had happened, all save for Zane, who returned later that week at night. He and a friend got locked out on the roof somehow, despite the broken mechanism, and had to call the police to get them down. According to S, the rumors of haunting at the Camcel were very believable, based on the experience they had there. In the Facebook group called I'm Obsessed with Charles Camcel Hospital, a user posted an entry from the Encyclopedia of Haunted Places by Jeff Bellanger about different sightings and experiences there, including photographs of orbs and apparitions who screamed, cried, and asked to go home. There is certainly an exploitative bent to some of these stories when we talk about the history of genocide and Indigenous oppression in Canada. I do think, however, it's important for us to understand the real history of Kamsale Hospital so that we can acknowledge its impact and the role played by the federal government and medical complex in so much suffering. There's enough within the experience of those individuals who were committed to Kamsale that I find haunting, without the possibility that their pain still lingers after death. Oof, that was a heavy one. The Charles Kamsale Hospital history is truly horrific. Maureen K. Lux, the author of Separate Beds, actually starts her book with the opening day of the Kamsale Hospital, and it is stomach-turning to read how for so many First Nations leaders, despite their experience being continually disenfranchised and oppressed by the government, they truly saw the opening of the Indian hospitals as a final relief for their people who needed help. My hope is that the lawsuits being brought against these institutions can begin the healing process for those people who are still dealing with the aftermath, and that the journalists and activists who are working to have relevant records released succeed, so that family members can find closure for the loved ones they lost. As for the Princess Theater haunting, I couldn't find any records to substantiate the story of Sarah Ann, who took her life at the Princess Theater, in archives, obituaries, or newspapers, other than a single mention in an Edmonton Journal article from 2017, which seemed just to be re-articulating Nadine Bailey's story. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's false. White lady or woman in white type ghost stories are so incredibly common, and they're found in cultures around the world, including but far from limited to places like Europe, South America, Southeast Asia. We heard one in the first episode, actually, of Small Town Spooky about the woman in the white dress whose husband had possibly decapitated her, leaving her to roam the countryside looking for her head. Another well-known Lady in White ghost story, similar to Sarah Ann's actually, is the legend of Montmorency's Dame Blanche, or Montmorency's Lady in White, centered on the Montmorency Falls in Quebec, where a woman supposedly leapt to her death in her wedding gown after finding out her lover had been killed at the base of the falls in the Battle of Beauport in 1759. There seems to be a reasonably strong case for white lady ghosts kind of being this imported folkloric theme by Canada's early settler population, especially those from the UK and Eastern Europe. I was in a bit of a research rabbit hole, and I came across this article called The White Lady of Great Britain and Ireland for the scholarly publication Folklore by Jane C. Beck, who posits that these apparitions are based on pagan beliefs of river goddesses due to the White Lady's tendency to appear near bodies of water in various folk stories in the UK, and that perhaps they were sublimated into legends about fairy queens, or specifically the banshee, who's a known harbinger of death, or maybe that they were repurposed from fairy legends in areas where stories about fairies were less popular. With all the research that went into this episode, I didn't really get the chance to dig into the folklore aspect of these white lady or woman in white type hauntings as much as I wanted to. I'd love to explore the connection between ladies in white and bodies in water, especially since I think there is something about how fog rises off the water and what that might look like to someone who just happens to glance at it. Anyway, I would love to cover this in a future episode if someone has their own hometown scary they want to share featuring a lady in white type ghost. You can send it in via email at smalltownspooky@gmail.com, or you can direct message me on the socials at smalltownspooky. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a starred review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, and check out the Small Town Spooky website, smalltownspooky.wixsite.com/home, to see how you can support it, to look at pictures and read the episode transcripts that I post every week. You can email, like I said, or message at Small Town Spooky on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook saying what you liked about the episode, or leave your scariest small town story to be featured on an upcoming show. Until next time, thank you so much for listening and hope to spook you soon. Special thanks to the providers of the music for this episode. The title theme is taken from Brian Mathis' song, It's Not Hard to Get Lost, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0, along with the background songs July by Kai Engel, Autumn Sunset by Jason Shaw, Vychodnoy by Costa T, Clusticus the Mistaken, and You're Right But I'm Me by Dr. Turtle. Lysticia by Kai Engel is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial International 4.0, and Rose of the World by the Victor Herbert Orchestra is licensed under Public Domain Mark 1.0.